From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world lost a legend today. The genius of soul, as Ray Charles was known, died of liver disease at the age of 73 in his Beverly Hills home, surrounded by friends and family. Ray Charles had his first number one hit with Georgia on My Mind in 1960. By the end of the century, his musical voice was, for many, the voice of America. 2 months ago in Rolling Stone, Van Morrison wrote, "It's all Ray Charles music now." Tonight on Point, celebrating the genius of soul, Ray Charles. But first we turn to Sea Island, Georgia, where President Bush concluded the G8 summit of leaders of major industrial economies and more with a news conference this afternoon. Over the two-day summit, President Bush mended fences with European leaders and outlined a proposal for limited NATO involvement in Iraq. Tamara Lipper, White House correspondent for Newsweek, spoke with me from Savannah, Georgia. I asked her how the president is tallying up the summit's outcome.
Well, I think from his perspective, we saw it best at his press conference, the final event here before he left Georgia to head back to Washington to participate in the funeral events for President Reagan. He was extremely upbeat. This was the loosey-goosey kind of George Bush that the press see oftentimes in private, but perhaps the public doesn't see. And he was really pleased, particularly with the progress made on Iraq, that he can come out of the summit saying that the international community is firmly behind the new government that's going to be taking over there after June 30th. And they seem to have made some progress, although nothing definitive yet, on the possibility of both economic and other assistance for the new government of Iraq from the international community. This was an opening round, if you will, of discussions on that subject with the major other world leaders in terms of issues like debt relief or perhaps some role for NATO in the continued effort in Iraq going forward.
President Bush specifically looked for a NATO role in Iraq. Has he come away with any sign that NATO might, in fact, step up and become involved, help share the burden?
He was very clear in his press conference, and he's been asked this question over and over again in the last couple of days. Basically, what the U.S. is looking for, what he's looking for, is not what we generally think he should be looking for, which is NATO troops on the ground in Iraq. He says that's not a realistic expectation. No one thinks that's going to happen. But he says there are other things NATO can do. One of the things that he said that he raised in his meetings this week was having NATO participate in the training of Iraqi security forces, saying that they could be very effective in helping the Iraqis build up their own forces so they're is less of a need for international and U.S. In particular troops on the ground there in Iraq.
Debt relief, any concrete commitments?
I hate to sound like a broken record, but there were some good discussions according to the White House, but nothing definitive yet. There have been general pledges of debt relief, and countries like Japan, for instance, have pledged to forgive almost all of Iraq's debt. But from the other countries, everyone agrees on the principle that Iraq can't handle right now the huge amount of debt it has sustained, and everyone sort of recognizes that. But in terms of specific dollars that each nation's willing to forgive, they haven't reached that kind of level of detailed discussion yet.
So $120 billion in foreign debt for Iraq still sitting unaddressed, but maybe an opening conversation there. What about the president's relations with European leaders at this summit? They've been so difficult in recent years. Gerhard Schroeder of Germany and Jacques Chirac of France were both there. Did you see a warming?
You did see a warming, and what was interesting, I think, is that you actually saw those two leaders almost, I don't want to say curry favor, that might be too strong, but trying to sort of meet the president on his turf, play on his ground. We saw Jacques Chirac this morning praise the cuisine here at Sea Island, that he enjoyed the local southern food and said that it was on par with French food.
The famous cheeseburger that George Bush then brought up.
And the president joked that it's more important for the chef to hear that kind of comment from the president of France than from him.
Right.
The same thing with Chancellor Schroeder. We saw the chancellor taking the wheel of his own golf cart the way President Bush is so fond of doing. Schroeder seemed to be taking a page from President Bush's book in his own transportation choices.
And what about the Bush administration's big vision for reform in the Middle East? What kind of reception from Arab nations at and not at the summit, though they were all invited? What kind of reception from other G8 members?
It depends on what your expectations are. From the White House perspective, they got a great reception in that there's no question now everybody is discussing the need for these countries to start bringing democratic reforms in the Middle East, that the idea that it's somehow a subject that Western countries shouldn't put on the table, shouldn't demand of Middle Eastern leaders, has been sort of removed. They've all had to engage on it. They've all had to have 2 days of discussions on it. And I think there's a little bit of each side adopting a little bit from the other's approach. The European leaders, who have been a little wary about this Greater Middle East initiative, had a chance to sit down and really discuss what the president had in mind and agree to sort of the broad premises behind it. But then we also had the Middle Eastern leaders who did come to Georgia as well participate in the discussions, what it means, which answers some of the concerns of Middle Eastern and European leaders that the president, that the United States, was trying to dictate terms or conditions to that part of the world.
And finally, Tamara, what about the president's body language and interaction with Iraq's new interim Prime Minister Ghazi al-Yawar? How did that relationship look? How much will it matter?
It will matter hugely, because basically the president has cast his lot very much so with this new, largely untested, unknown to a lot of people, interim government in Iraq. So it's a very crucial relationship. And, you know, the president had a couple things he wanted to hear from the Iraqi leader. One was something that the two had discussed on the phone before they met, actually for the first time in person, which was him basically saying thank you and showing some appreciation for the sacrifice of American men and women's lives in Iraq. And that's something that President Yawar repeated yesterday. And the other thing was that to hear that the Iraqi leader himself was asking for U.S. and international help, that this was not being done to Iraq, but it was being done for Iraq. So those were two important things to hear from the new Iraqi president himself. And, you know, we saw the president during that meeting after they had some discussions. They invited reporters into the room, and you did see that the president was visibly moved. I mean, he did comment that a year and a half ago it was hard even for him to imagine sitting side by side a president of a country that was headed for democratic elections in the not-too-distant future. And they're not going to go around sort of screaming from the mountaintops, we were right, or anything like that. But there is a certain sense of quiet satisfaction and real emotion that they've come this far. Administration officials are still saying that there's a difficult road ahead. No one's saying we're out of the woods yet. But in terms of milestones, this certainly was one.
And now the big summit in Georgia breaks up. President Bush headed back to Washington. Tamara Lipper, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Tamara Lipper is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She spoke with me from Savannah, Georgia.
Well, I got a woman way over town. That's good to me. Oh, yeah.
By the time he died today in Beverly Hills at 73, Ray Charles was more than a musician. His unmistakable voice could seem like the voice of the nation. Earthy, high-humored, joyful, inconsolable, and so alive, Ray Charles' 1954 recording of I've Got a Woman has been called the launch of soul music. His recording of Georgia on My Mind is Georgia's official state song, but really the comforting balm of a whole country. He won 12 Grammys. Arenas across the country have rung with his gravelly, glorious rendition of America the Beautiful. Ray Charles embodied something raw and wonderful and deeply, authentically American. He was born in segregation Georgia in 1930 to a poor family that was, in his words, on the bottom of the ladder. He was blind by age 6. His parents had both died by the time he was 15. At 22, he had inked a deal with Atlantic Records, and stardom was only a few recordings away. Over the next 50 years, Ray Charles would bring his unmistakable sound and soul to the worlds of gospel, blues, R&B, rock and roll, and more. Tonight on Point, celebrating the life and music of Mr. Ray Charles. When you close your eyes and hear Ray Charles, what do you hear? Why did he sound like the voice of the nation? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Michael Lydon, author of Ray Charles, Man and Music, and a founding editor of Rolling Stone magazine. Good evening and welcome, Michael Lydon.
Good evening.
It's great to be here. It's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
And joining me from Somerville, Massachusetts, is Al Cooper, a longtime musician, singer, songwriter, and producer, and a former professor at the Berklee College of Music. He was the music director for Ray Charles' 50th anniversary special broadcast in 1991. Good evening and welcome, Al Cooper.
Good evening.
It is a sad day for Ray Charles and his family, but yet we hear in the music behind us what will never go away. Al Cooper, you knew him, you worked with him. Your thoughts on this day, the day Ray Charles at 73 has left us?
It's inconceivable to me. I can't believe that there's a world that Ray Charles isn't walking around in. I just can't believe it.
He was touring only recently. How long was his illness?
I don't know. I think I heard about 5 weeks ago that he was ill.
Liver disease. Michael Lydon, what can you tell us about the last year or difficult time of Ray Charles? For a lot of us, this comes as a surprise.
Well, he was on tour last spring. Pretty much his regular tour started out, and I saw him at Atlantic City over the 4th of July weekend, and then he continued his upstate New York and in Pennsylvania, and then he was going to come into the Blue Note at New York in the first weekend in August, and that was canceled. And it was just temporary, and he was having hip replacement surgery. But then another call came to the fellows in the band: pack up your stuff, go home, it's over. And I think when he was troubled with something in his hip, but when he went to the hospital and had it checked out, it wasn't just arthritis, it was liver cancer. And then he fought through a fall. He's been recording a duets album at his studio in Los Angeles through the fall, mm-hmm. but progressively getting weaker. And reports that I got from people who were close to him was that he put up an extremely brave battle. He actually scheduled a performance at Lincoln Center for March 2nd. But apparently those who knew him knew it really couldn't happen. And it was just Ray determined to go on working to the last minute. Apparently in the past few months, he was still going to his office. When he made money from Georgia hit the road, Jack, he bought land in Los Angeles and built a building which became his studio, 2107 West Washington Boulevard. And that was truly Ray Charles' home on earth. He would go back there and work at every opportunity. So in the past few weeks and months, his office became a bedroom, and he would go there. I don't know if he could really get anything done, but he was determined to go to the office and the studio as long as he possibly could.
Didn't they make that an official landmark recently?
Yes, just very recently. And I'm very glad because it is a landmark, and it will be wonderful that it's there, the place where he made 35 years of beautiful, beautiful records.
What Did I Say, the record that helped him begin to put that all together, 1959, huge hit, transcended Race, one of the first albums from Ray Charles that did that. We're going to learn a lot about the life of this man that we all know is an icon, but not necessarily the biography tonight. But Al Cooper, just in terms of his music, what was it that made him so absolutely somehow the soul of America?
Well, originally he fused gospel music and created really rhythm and blues almost single-handedly by borrowing from gospel music and blues music and sort of piecing them together. And he was criticized by the religious community for doing that, but he just said, well, you know, this is what I do, and this is who I am, and sorry.
Sacred and profane and also, we're going to hear a lot more. Al Cooper, Michael Lydon, please stand by. We are celebrating the life and music of Ray Charles today. Ray Charles died today in Beverly Hills at age 73. We're going to hear much more about his life, about the music that we have all shared of Ray Charles. When you close your eyes and hear Ray Charles, what do you hear? Why did he sound like the voice of the nation? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Come on, baby, see about me now, yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, the life and music of Ray Charles, dead today in Beverly Hills at age 73. Let's listen to his great hit, Georgia on My Mind.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines.
Ray Charles, Georgia on my mind. Ray Charles dead today at 73. Join our conversation tonight. What was it about the music and manner of Ray Charles that resonated with so many Americans? White, black, rich, poor, right across generations. Why did he sound like the voice of the nation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from New York by Michael Lydon, author of the biography Ray Charles, Man and Music. And from Somerville, Massachusetts, we're joined by Al Cooper, musician, singer, songwriter, producer. He was musical director of Ray Charles' 50th anniversary TV special in 1991. Michael Lydon, take us back and give us the story of this man's youth. You can't help but wonder where this soul comes from. And we know he polished it very deliberately, but there was a lot that was simply in his life story here. Give us the beginning.
Well, I think God gave Ray Charles great, great gifts of musicality and intelligence. But when he was born to a very, very poor family. He was actually born in Albany, Georgia, but his family, his mother had been sent home to have the baby, and she came back to this little town, Greenville, Florida, which is a little bit east of Tallahassee. And they lived in the outskirts of the town, in the little area where black people had settled coming in from the plantations. Extreme poverty, but also a nurturing community. His mother, Aretha Williams Robinson, was a highly intelligent, capable woman, determined that when her son went blind, he wouldn't end up with a cane and a tin cup.
He went blind very early, age six or seven.
About six, mm-hmm. Yes, just about six.
And what was the cause, Michael Lydon?
Well, no one really knows, but I've spoken to doctors who guessed it was a kind of congenital glaucoma. And it took about a year of his sight slowly faded away. But his mother spoke to influential white people in the town, mm-hmm. and arranged for him to go to this Florida school for the deaf and blind in St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And he went there for the next 6 or 7 years, or even longer, until he was about 15. He got an excellent education, and a particularly an excellent musical education. He learned music to read music by reading Braille. And I hope the listeners can imagine, to learn the right hand of the piano, he had to read the Braille with his left hand. And then to learn the other way, he had to switch hands and then put it all together. So that was a first sign of both his musicality and his extraordinary intelligence.
And we read that he learned to write music in Braille as well, playing Chopin, Art Tatum.
That's right. That's right. And he also, many of his early arrangements, he dictated, having thought out the arrangement note for note of, you know, maybe three saxes and two trumpets in his head, and then would dictate them to a band member. And all the fellows who took his dictation said he never made a mistake.
We know him as a pianist and a singer, but those were not his only instruments early on.
He played sax, and then I think arranging and making records really was not exactly an instrument, but a means of expression for himself, and so that he could do it all. One of the things that really stands out about Ray, he was never the creation of a producer. He was his own producer. He, from the very beginning, determined his own sound, and it had to be Ray's way. Jerry Wexler and Armin Erdogan worked with him in the beginning, but soon they just let him go to be himself and to do his own thing.
This would not be a cookie-cutter musician at 15.
Never.
His mother died. He left the school, went to Jacksonville to earn a living as a musician, and dropped the Robinson, his family name, surname Robinson, to go with Ray Charles. Why?
Well, that came a little later when he was in Seattle, when a record company was first putting out his first record. His first record made the charts in 1949, actually. And confusion with Sugar Ray Robinson. He was known as R.C. Robinson in his youth.
Ray Charles and Robinson, and
Ray
there
Charles
was Sugar
Robinson,
Ray.
Mm-hmm. And there was Sugar Ray, so they said, well, how about Ray Charles? And he said, fine. But he's never changed it legally, and on numerous of his records, he listed himself as engineer as Ray Robinson.
Al Kooper, speak to Ray Charles' voice, the quality of his voice. This was not a pure and beautiful operatic voice. It seemed to have all kinds of sort of wonderful creases and surprising dropouts and the character. How do you describe it?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to put it into words. It just cut through everything to the soul of each person that heard it. And he just didn't play any games, just came out there and sang right to your heart and just, you know, ripped into it.
And when you worked with him, when you put together the 50th anniversary special in 91, what was the personality of this man? How did he relate with you, with the people around him, his peers, and those who weren't necessarily his peers, those who, you know, helping them put on a show?
Well, he was very much in control. That was always the key thing with Ray. And so, you know, you just kind of jumped on the train and went along for the ride.
In control as in perfectionist, as in...
No, as in the way he wanted it to be.
And that's how it would be.
I mean, you know, same as the records, you know. We were doing a TV thing. I'm glad, you know, that I wasn't in charge of it. Because, you know, it's whatever he wanted it to be, that's the way it would work out.
Michael Iden, where did that confidence come from? Here was an orphaned, blind young man from no means in Florida, and he emerges by his 20s as a real player, a real factor. Where do you see that in his character? Where did it come from?
Well, I think his mother, Aretha, is the heart of his character. She was a very tough-minded woman. When he was starting to go blind, she still made him cut the kindling and fetch water from the well, even if he tripped, even if he maybe cut himself, because she said, you may be blind, but you're not stupid. People will not do for you. You've got to learn to do for yourself. He was quoting his mother. In any conversation of more than 10 minutes, Ray Charles would mention his mother. So I think that iron solid determination and self-reliance came directly from her. Other than that, he was just enormously intelligent and determined. He once said, I can't see any reason why the music can't come out the way I hear it in my head. And that sentence explains why he would shout at sound men, why he would, in the middle of a performance, shout at the saxophone player, man, you're playing that scale wrong. You come in too early.
Right.
And endless perfection in the studio. He had a vision, and he said that music was life, like his blood, like his heart, like his guts. And so he couldn't help it. He was wildly ambitious, driven, and obsessive in a way, and powerful and determined.
And he heard it in his head, and he wanted it to be played just
that
way.
He wanted it the way he heard it, and he couldn't see any reason why that
not to have
be.
It. That's terrific.
Michael Cooper or anybody else.
Deliver it. He wants it. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to begin to invite them in. Jennifer's calling from North Arlington, New Jersey. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I guess I just wanted to say what stood out for me is when you talked about how I'm 32 years old,
mm-hmm.
and his music has really, gone across generations and races. And I think it's like with Peggy Lee and Nina Simone. It's like when you hear that voice, you know, or that music, you just know there's brilliance there.
And why do you think it traveled so famously well across racial lines, Jennifer?
I can't really say for sure why that is. I think when there's something just so beautiful, I think people can't turn away from it. And I think that's when I first heard him, that it just was beautiful.
It was always hard to turn away and always hard to stop humming it. What's your favorite Ray Charles song, Jennifer?
Georgia.
Yeah.
I just was listening to it on the radio program.
Who can resist it? Thanks so much for your call. I want to turn
on that question of
Michael.
On that question of reaching across racial lines, It did, certainly in America. It also reached around the world. The Japanese love Ray Charles. The French love Ray Charles. The Italians love Ray Charles. And I think he was blind. He knew he was a black man, and he suffered for it, and he didn't like it, the suffering part of it. But musically, he didn't care. He was a broadcaster to the world, to the universe. He sent it out, and he just reached a level of emotion where us humans are all the same.
In the early days of his recording, his music was still called race music, if I've got that right. I mean, there really was a color stamp put on it.
Well, yes, and the you know, like any business that was divided along racial lines, because there was a market and the record companies that catered to that market, and there was a performance circuit. One thing that's worth mentioning about Ray is that during the 50s, he really started performing, let's say, about 1949, out really in the public and with records. From then until, what did I say, in 59, he went on a very long, slow climb, whereas Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Little Richard, and Fats Domino came up suddenly, very quickly.
Yeah.
Ray had this long, slow climb, and in those years, he built an enormously close, affectionate following with the black community, and that was his base. And even those folks are now granddaddies and grandmas, they connected with Ray Charles in those long years of touring, and when his records were really only available in the black community, and he only performed in the black community, that created a bond that was the foundation he built on for everything else.
Michael Lydnell Cooper, I want to turn to a musician who played with Ray Charles. Roy Haynes joins us from New York. He was a jazz drummer who recorded with Ray Charles in the 1960s. He played on the song Mint Julep, among others. Roy Haynes was awarded an honorary doctorate from the New England Conservatory of Music at this year's commencement. We're happy to have you with us on this sad day, Roy Haynes. Thanks for joining us tonight.
No problem at all. It's really a sad day.
It is a sad day, Ray Charles, 73, and passing on today. Your thoughts on this day of this incredible musician, Roy Haynes?
Well, my thoughts. I just heard it probably an hour ago on a radio station here in New York. In fact, they're playing his music now. My thoughts. It's been a very sad period because so many of my dear friends are leaving.
Yeah.
Elvin Jones, a couple of weeks ago. He was a drummer as well. But I was first introduced to Ray Charles' music back in the late 50s. I happened to be in Miami, Florida. I was playing at the Fountain Blue with Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah.
And Cannonball Adderley. You familiar with Cannonball Adderley?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. He had brought me over to this restaurant to have something to eat, and there was a jukebox in there. I'm talking about late 50s now. And a couple of Ray Charles records were on there, and I was in love with him ever since then, not even realizing that I would have the opportunity to record with him.
What was it like to record with Ray Charles? Was he the controlling mastermind that we're hearing described by Al Cooper and Michael?
Very controlling, because he had a couple of different arrangers there. Quincy Jones was there, and a couple of other guys. They all had arrangements. First of all, Ray Charles arrived maybe 2 or 3 hours late, and we had been rehearsing all of these arrangements. And when he came in, he changed everything. You know, he was blind. He didn't know I was playing drums, but he said, "Drummer, do this on, I think it was maybe a one-minute julep. That's one of the tracks that I did."
Yeah, we can hear it right now.
He did what he wanted right away. He changed the whole arrangement.
And what was the flavor that Ray Charles reached for that you all hadn't come up with on your own? Was there a constant sort of theme or flavor that he would want?
That he would, he knew the beat he wanted. Yeah, he was one of those rare geniuses. You know, he has a certain thing in mind, and that's how he deals with it.
Wow, and we hear it on every track and every cut, and we will hear it for a long, long time. The man may be gone, but his music will not be going away. Roy Haynes, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're quite welcome. Thank you as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us on this day. Let's get one more call. Jerry's calling from London, Ontario in Canada. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I have some serious and some joking comments.
Yeah.
George on my mind seems the world seems to have George E.W. on its mind. He beat the drugs, which is more than I can say for Rolling Stone magazine, and just a little joke. You know, the best thing about him was he lived with his disability after his mother was gone. And, you know, I think he was a greater American than Reagan. And I remember that old Saturday Night Live sketch where you know, Belushi and everybody saying, the young Caucasians saying, "What did I say?" You know,
yeah.
Jane Curtin says, You know that line about Arkansas. That's funny. I got an uncle from Arkansas. You know, and you know, my
Ray Charles somehow above all of that, and right there.
Yeah, you know, my least favorite song is "You Got One, Baby." I don't think it's a sad day at all because, like, I think he can see God now. You know, I don't think anybody should cry because, like, he can see God now.
We always wondered if that might be who he was seeing. Jerry, thanks so much for calling from London, Ontario. Al Kooper, Ray Charles, seeing God on this day, somehow he knew how to make us laugh. He could bring out that cackling laugh and get everybody going with it, but he could also just make a room or an arena cry.
Easily. Just was one of the greatest voices there ever was. And it's really fortunate that he lived in an era where it could be recorded and kept around so that we can always hear it.
Well, it's just about as around as it could possibly be. We're looking tonight at the life and music of music great Ray Charles, dead today in Beverly Hills at age 73 from liver disease. We're joined tonight by Michael Leiden, biographer of Ray Charles. His biography is Ray Charles, Man and Music. And by Al Kooper, musician, songwriter, producer, worked with Ray Charles on his 50th anniversary TV special in 1991. You can join our conversation as well. What was it about this man, this singer, his music, his spirit, Ray Charles, that touched so many Americans so deeply? It got us up. It took us down. It was unique. Ray Charles, dead today at 73. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Don't you come back no more. What you say? The road.
Treat me this away, cause I'll be back on my feet someday.
Don't care if you call this understood. You ain't got no money, you just ain't no good.
Well, I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right, hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more, no more.
Ray Charles, dead today at 73. What made him the great American musician? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're celebrating the life and music of Ray Charles tonight here from 1984 with Willie Nelson, Seven Spanish Angels.
He looked down into her brown eyes and said, say a prayer for me. She threw her arms around him, whispered, God will keep us free. They could hear the riders coming. He said, this is my last fight. If they take me back to Texas, they won't take me back alive. There were seven Spanish angels at the altar of the sun. They were praying for the lovers in the valley of the gun. When the battle stopped and the smoke cleared, there was thunder from the throne. And seven Spanish angels took another angel home.
Ray Charles in a 1984 duet with Willie Nelson, Seven Spanish Angels. Wow. There's the beauty. Ray Charles dead today at age 73. When you close your eyes and hear Ray Charles, what do you hear? Why did he sound like the voice of the nation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Michael Lydon from New York, author of Ray Charles, Man and Music, and by Al Cooper, who worked with Willie Nelson on his 50th anniversary TV special, a lifelong musician, singer, songwriter, and producer himself. What an amazing sound. I'm reading here from the New York Times saying, Ray Charles could belt like a blues shouter and croon like a pop singer. He could, with a laugh or a sob, he could slip into an intimate whisper. He could let loose a whoop. He could sound suave or raw, brash or hesitant, joyful or desolate, insouciant or tearful, earthy or devout. He projected the primal exuberance of a field holler and the sophistication of a bebopper. That, Michael Lydon, is quite a range.
Well, that says it very, very well. Vocally, I don't know any singer in any genre anywhere who had the range of colors of Ray Charles. There was nothing beyond him in being able to express emotion with his voice. He sang, you know, it's absolutely right that he sang very often with a rough flavor, but you listen to his records, he sings like a classically trained singer. He takes a beautiful breath. He supports his breath right to the very end. If he sings Dream, you hear a long E and then a perfectly articulated M to finish it off. Talk to a vocal teacher who teaches opera singers, and they'll say Ray Charles had a gorgeous voice.
Al Cooper, you've been performed on recordings with Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Rolling Stones, The Who. You were a member of the legendary Blues Project. When you listen to Ray Charles' voice, do you hear the raw voice or the polished voice? How do you sum it up?
Well, I said before, you know, it's just it cuts through everything and just goes right to your heart. You can enjoy it soulfully, or you can enjoy it intellectually as a musician. It's there any way you want it. But I mean, he's like, you know, Shakespeare of soul music.
couldn't say it better.
People say far-fetched things sometimes, on, you know, in the early moments of sadness in this, but this I agree completely. He is one of those great artists who transcends time. Shakespeare.
But it wasn't just his voice. You know, as Michael said before, he created a style of arranging that was unique, that came from him. On that album he did with Roy Haynes, which was called Genius Plus Soul Equals Jazz.
Right.
They did jazz music, and he made a hit single out of it. Plus, he played organ on it, and did something that no other organist had ever done before, which is there's a revolving speaker that you play through, and you control the speed of it either fast, or it just goes in a slow mode if you're not, you know, adjusting it.
And he insisted
that they turn the slow mode off and just get rid of the speaker moving at all. And no one had ever really done that before. And then whenever he played organ on a record, you could tell it was him because the speaker wasn't turning.
That unique sound right there. He could bring that sound to anything he touched.
Yep.
Let's listen for just a moment to Yesterday, the Beatles song, Ray Charles cover. He could take any song and make
Yesterday,
it his own.
All my troubles seem so far away. Night looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not a happy man I used to be. No, no, no. There's a shadow hanging over me. For yesterday.
Mike is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I think Ray Charles was singing from his heart rather than his head. I'm not saying he didn't have all these techniques and all that slick stuff down. I'm a musician, And I know that the universities are turning out a lot of slick musicians. They teach them how to do everything. But there was something that was universal because it resonated the emotions of the people. And in order to do that, you have to have that inside. And I think he was maybe being blind and going through all the hell that he must have gone through enabled him to accomplish that.
Amen. I mean, you just want to sit down and soak it up. Whenever he would be on, when he'd come on, Mike, I don't know about you, but I would just want to focus on this and let it resonate off my own emotions, off my own soul.
Mm-hmm. I feel so bad about this. You know, President Reagan was a great loss, but to me this guy was a loss of the heart. This drives deeply, and it doesn't matter what the race or your class is. We're all human. We all suffer. We all die. This is existence, and it's raw, and it hits the inside of you. If you don't feel that, you're already dead. So I just cannot say enough for Ray Charles.
We hear it. We hear it all the way. Michael Lydon.
I think that's absolutely true. I whenever I saw Ray Charles, I saw him many times in performance, there was always a time in the show I would say about it, he puts you on the griddle. You'd be at some fancy hotel or in a beautiful convention hall, and it would be glossy and tuxedos, and you'd be out with your best girl. But he would, in somewhere in the music, he'd get to the point where it wasn't just pretty. It was almost ugly. It was painful.
Yeah.
He would stretch something out,
twist
and you would
it.
Feel,
yeah.
I'm on a date. I don't want to feel about this. But you'd actually be glad. This is catharsis. This is art reaching people. And about the head, heart, I think I see Ray as both. Because, for instance, I was hearing a little bit earlier today after the news came on the radio, America the Beautiful. Mm-hmm. And he's singing this, God don't shed his grace on you. And he's like using vernacular language.
Mm-hmm.
But he planned that at the same time. How do you explain what seems like sudden shouts? He would do the same sudden shout every night, night after night. So there's this combination of extraordinary musical calculation for effect, using things, at the same time, straight from the heart. There was no intellectual barrier at all. How he combined the two, I don't know. That's maybe what part of his genius.
But that's essentially what great art is, isn't it? Mark is calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah.
One of your guests suggested Shakespeare as a tie-in with Ray Charles. I'd like to suggest another, and that's Mark Twain.
Oh, yes, I hear
very
that. But why do you say it? I feel it, but why do you say it?
Because Mark Twain, time and again, in Mysterious Stranger, in Huck Finn, in Tom Sawyer, he talks about an idealized village where he grew up. It's this village drowsing in the sun that he can relate to, and everyone reading his books can relate to. And when Ray Charles sings about Georgia on his mind, it's the exact same thing that he's touching.
Even if you've never set foot in Georgia, he takes you to some extraordinary place.
It's this mythical place that he grew up in, that all of us grew up in, whether it was Georgia or Hannibal, Missouri, or someplace in California. It doesn't matter.
That is a great link, Mark, and we thank you for making it. And I'm still not sure I entirely understand why it works, but it sure does work. Michael Lydon, speak to, our time is so short and we could listen so long, speak to Ray Charles' adult life off the stage. What was the texture of it? What were the main elements of it?
Well,
he was married twice, had 9 children, 7 by 7 women, so we know he had a wide-ranging love life, but what most mattered?
Well, he was, many women found him attractive and he went after them with a great deal of pleasure. I think a turning point in his adult life was, well, first when he made his first serious money with in the early 60s, and the intelligence with which he invested that money in his own career and in the control and controlling his own career. And the second was in the mid-60s, he was busted in Boston for flying in from Canada with heroin on his plane. And this was, he had been busted a few times before, but they were minor municipal busts and easily gotten rid of. There was no getting rid of this one. And so he was faced with a choice, heroin or his career, heroin or music, and he chose music. And he checked himself into a hospital in the summer of 1965, I believe, and came out clean and stayed clean. And that control, that determination, that common sense, using willpower over habit, is a mark of them. And we can wish that Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday and so many others had done the same thing. And then after that, that was almost the last bad news that happened to Ray Charles that got out publicly. He created a very successful public relations facade inside which he could live his life with his women friends, with his traveling, with his chess games, with his buddies.
Yeah.
And so the Ray Charles of the day-to-day, the world didn't see, but he... It was basically centered in Los Angeles at his studio and then touring out into the world and then coming back to Los Angeles. And hard work, just making the gigs night after night, Japan to Australia to England. Constant hard work.
And he kept it up and he kept it up and he kept it up.
Kept it up and kept it up.
Al Kooper... You know, you think of Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, the Stones, others that you've recorded with. The presence of this man, was there a common thread with these other musicians, or do you really see him in a class of his own?
Well, those other musicians wouldn't have existed without him coming first.
Mm.
He influenced all those people tremendously. And he was, as I say, he was... the master of control of the situation he was in, where some of those people might not always have been as much as Ray was. You were on Ray's train, and if you weren't, then you got off at the next stop.
but who wanted to get off? It was a beautiful train to be on. Michael Lydon, how do you see the imprint of this man, this musician, ultimately on American music of the last decades of a century?
Well, I think his great contribution was his ability and his gift to weave so many different colors of the American music fabric into one tapestry. And I think that we were mentioning Shakespeare and other comparisons. My biggest comparison really is with Rembrandt, in that just as Rembrandt year after year painted his paintings in his studio in Amsterdam, Ray Charles, year after year, created his sound paintings in his studio in Los Angeles. And his records, and like Rembrandt's paintings, have that depth of emotional understanding that speaks across the centuries. 200 years from now, people will listen to Georgia, and they will connect with it just like we connect with the faces and the eyes of a Rembrandt painting, and will know Ray Charles lived as we live, he suffered as we suffered, he fell in love and... as we fall in love, and he was afraid of dying as we were afraid of dying, and all these things, we will commune with his spirit through his beautiful, beautiful records.
And he helped us feel all those things so deeply.
Amen.
In all those shadings. Amen. Michael Lydon, wonderful having you tonight. Thank you so much for being with us.
All right.
Michael Lydon, author of Ray Charles, Man and Music, and Al Kooper, can't thank you enough for joining us on this day to remember Ray Charles. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ray Charles, dead today at age 73 in Beverly Hills. We're going to close the hour with Ray Charles performing America the Beautiful. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
See you.